Heard. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 6, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Alex Gonzalez and Mike Moen. The producer is Annette Newell. Our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest and KBOO News in Depth up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Six elections that tell us about the strengths and weaknesses of democracies. China raises the pressure on Taiwan and Hong Kong. And human rights under fire in Venezuela. Six elections in democracies. South Africa, India, and Mexico just held general elections. Britain will hold a general election July 4th. The U.S. will hold one November 5th. Record-setting demonstrations in Israel may yet lead to a general election there. Five of these six elections reveal the precarious hold on power of the incumbents. In South Africa, voters dealt the ruling African National Congress, the party of Nelson Mandela, a seismic blow, according to CNN. For the first time in 30 years, the party failed to win a majority, falling to 41%. Official corruption is endemic in that party, but also in the party of President Cyril Ramaphosa's predecessor, Jacob Zuma. Zuma, who ruled for 9 years, heads a new party that received about 14% of the vote. He now appears to be the kingmaker, as the ANC will need partners in a coalition government. But it is doubtful Zuma will accept having Ramaphosa continue as president. If no coalition forms over the next few weeks, then by law, new elections will need to be held. Britain's Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has been on the job for less than 2 years before calling an early election May 30th, fully aware that the Tories are miles behind Labour in opinion polls. Sunak made some terrible decisions on the public health system and refugees from Rwanda that surely helped sink him. In two countries, the U.S. and Israel, the rule of law is critical to the survival of democratic governance. The Biden administration has received a huge shot in the arm with the conviction of Donald Trump on 34 counts of violations of federal law. From now on, he will be identified as convicted felon Trump. But he's ahead in the polls. In mud, unimaginable as it may seem, the next U.S. president could be a criminal who has not only been convicted of multiple counts of fraud, but also faces various conspiracy charges and rape. In Israel, the International Criminal Court is seeking arrest warrants for two Israeli leaders, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, as well as three Hamas leaders. Netanyahu's authoritarian leadership is the subject of huge daily demonstrations calling for his resignation. But the arrest warrants offer war crimes committed in Gaza. Israel, however, is not a signatory to the Rome Treaty that established the International Criminal Court. Thus, the arrest warrants would not mean prosecution of Netanyahu and Gallant. Hamas, not being a nation state and therefore not party to the treaty, also would be difficult to prosecute. But it might make it difficult for all these people to travel abroad. Lacking any enforcement mechanism for its decisions, the International Court is powerless in the face of ongoing Israeli military actions in Gaza. The Netanyahu government is clearly not disturbed by these warrants, which it denounced. The Biden administration followed suit. But make no mistake, the president is well aware of Netanyahu's strategy for staying in power. In an interview with Time magazine, Biden asked whether Prime Minister Netanyahu was prolonging the war in Gaza in an effort to hold on to office, said he believes, quote, there is every reason for people to draw that conclusion. In two other countries, India and Mexico, ruling parties won in these latest elections. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi will have a third term, though his Hindu nationalist party, called the BJP, won far fewer seats in parliament than expected. Modi's intolerance toward Muslims and the economic inequalities that are growing as India's GDP rises evidently boosted the opposition Indian National Congress, India's second largest party. Dalits, the lowest caste, formerly called untouchables, abandoned the BJP, contributing importantly to Modi's low margin of victory. Modi has institutionalized himself, becoming increasingly authoritarian and dominating all media while putting opposing politicians in jail. Now he will have to govern in a coalition with other parties. Mexico is the exception in these elections. Claudia Sheinbaum, a leftist, won by a large margin to succeed her mentor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. She's a climatologist and Mexico's first female president. The vote was a mandate for Sheinbaum to continue López Obrador's anti-poverty programs, though according to the New York Times, he was, quote, a deeply polarizing president, criticized for failing to control rampant cartel violence, for hobbling the nation's health system, and for persistently undercutting democratic institutions, unquote. The cartels in particular are going to be a major challenge for Sheinbaum, both for the role they play in Mexican politics, as well as the complications they create in Mexico's relations with the United States. Can we draw any general conclusions from these elections? Probably the most important is the authoritarian tendencies of leaders in these democracies, most prominently in India and Israel. We keep learning that winning elections is not the same thing as governing democratically. Official corruption, violence against critics, disrespect for domestic and international law, and disregard for public opinion are often features of democratically elected rulers, as they are of rulers who are not elected. China raises the pressure on Taiwan and Hong Kong. For the third time in the last 2 years, China conducted major military maneuvers around Taiwan to protest indications of Taiwan and U.S. interest in the island's independence. This time, the exercises were in response to Taiwanese President Lai Ching-te's urging of Beijing in his inauguration speech to stop threatening the island. He said, quote, I hope that China will face the reality of Taiwan's existence, respect the choices of the people of Taiwan, and in good faith, choose dialogue over confrontation, exchange over containment, and under the principle of parity and dignity, engage in cooperation with the legal government chosen by Taiwan's people. But China's response was a military exercise called Joint Sword that included the Chinese Army, Navy, Air Force, and Rocket Force. And over a two-day period, these forces simulated a full-scale attack. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson said, quote, Taiwan is an inalienable part of China's territory. This is both a fact based on history and the true status quo. This will not change in the future. Taiwan independence is doomed to fail. In Hong Kong, a long-awaited trial resulted in the conviction of 14 democracy activists on charges of subversion brought under a national security law that was imposed by Beijing in 2020. That makes a total of 47 guilty verdicts in these trials. Hence, the group is now known as the Hong Kong 47. The verdicts make a mockery of China's promise to Great Britain in 1997, at the time of the turnover of Hong Kong to Beijing, that it would respect Hong Kong's democratic institutions for 50 years. And the verdicts come at a particularly poignant moment in Chinese political history, June 4, 1989, and the crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrations at Tiananmen Square. Human rights under fire in Venezuela. Presidential elections are coming in Venezuela, and that means more pressure than usual on human rights organizations, enemies of the people, according to the government headed by President Nicolas Maduro. Since Maduro took office in 2013, the Washington Post reports, PROVIA, shorthand for the most important human rights group, has identified more than 43,000 people whose right to personal integrity has been violated by torture and other inhumane treatment. PROVIA tallied more than 2,600 victims of human rights violations in 2023, up 20% from the previous year. The inhumane treatment, says the Washington Post, has led to at least 28 deaths inside the country's penitentiary center. PROVIA, despite having only 14 full-time workers, is recognized by Latin American rights organizations for its courageous work on behalf of human rights. With elections approaching, critics of the government, journalists, rights activists, opposition politicians, are under attack as never before. Marino Alvarado, head of PROVIA, says, quote, "People need our help now more than ever. So the government can outlaw us and threaten us all they want, but we will never stop advocating for Venezuela, its democracy, and the rights of its people." In other news, Chinese professors in Japan vanish after returning home. A Chinese professor who has taught at Hokkaido University of Education in Japan for 25 years has vanished after returning to China to attend his mother's funeral. He is the fourth Chinese professor teaching in Japan who has failed to return to Japan after visiting China. In each case, it has proven impossible to make contact with these professors. The Hokkaido University professor is being charged with espionage. His colleagues have started a petition drive in protest, but the reality is that the case will be dealt with behind a veil of secrecy until a sentence is handed down. The case is important not just for its likely impact on educational exchanges between China and Japan, but also because it reflects the worsening of their relations in general. Ken Suzuki, a professor of Chinese law at Meiji University in Tokyo, told University World News, quote, "Professor Yuan was not a political activist. Japanese and Chinese professors have begun rejecting offers to conduct research in China in order to avoid a similar fate. I see the risk facing this sector as only escalating in the future." China's treatment of these visiting professors is paralleled by the pressure brought to bear on Chinese students abroad who take advantage of academic freedom to talk critically about the Beijing government. Amnesty International has been tracking such cases. Quote, "The Chinese authorities have honed a strategy to curb students' human rights wherever they are in the world. The surveillance of overseas students and the targeting of their China-based family members are systematic tactics designed to control nationals from afar." So said Sarah Brooks, Amnesty International's China director. NATO is considering a training mission in Ukraine. Training Ukrainian soldiers has been a NATO mission ever since the war began. But putting that mission inside Ukraine, where soldiers from Europe and the U.S. would be exposed to Russian attack, is another story. President Biden remains opposed to the idea, but some NATO members, such as France, Estonia, and Lithuania, are warming to it as Ukraine loses ground and soldiers to Russian attacks. Ukraine has asked for training help for 150,000 new recruits. They could still be trained in Germany, Poland, and elsewhere outside Ukraine, but with time now critical, completing training and returning Ukrainian soldiers home would be costly. Besides dealing with putting trainers on the ground in Ukraine, there is also the question of allowing defense contractors there to work on building and repairing weapons systems. The U.S. has also rejected that idea, but is now reportedly rethinking it. Russia has been adamant about the threat posed by NATO forces based in Ukraine. The other week, a Kremlin spokesman said, quote, "The European leaders talked about the readiness and even the intention to send armed contingents to Ukraine. That is, in fact, to put NATO soldiers in front of the Russian military. This is a completely new round of escalation of tension. It is unprecedented. It requires special attention and special measures," unquote. Next, a Middle East package deal, pie in the sky? The Biden administration has been working on a package deal with Saudi Arabia that would guarantee a path to a Palestinian state in return for a permanent ceasefire and establishment of Saudi-Israel relations. But the Saudis want more for themselves, a U.S.-Saudi mutual defense pact and cooperation on a civilian nuclear program in the kingdom. Those are steps too far. They risk bringing the U.S. into a war with Iran and contributing to a peaceful nuclear program that could evolve into a Saudi bomb program. program. The biggest obstacle to this deal is Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu's government is unalterably opposed to a Palestinian state. The high-level diplomacy with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS as he's known, as reported by the New York Times, seems designed to force Netanyahu's hand, take the deal and obtain formal recognition from the Saudis, or fight an endless war with decreasing support from your friends. Peace or isolation, in short. But don't bet on a change of mind in Tel Aviv. These people care most about staying in power and cleansing Israel of an entire people. And that's quite apart from the merits of the proposed deal, which, to my mind, argue against pursuing it in its present form. You can't trust MBS any more than you can trust Netanyahu. Finally, on the global health front, an international treaty on pandemics fails. Despite a widespread belief among health scientists that the next pandemic is just around the corner, governments belonging to the World Health Assembly were unable to agree on a treaty that would assure equitable distribution of vaccines, sharing of data, and reliable supply chains. "I'm still optimistic," said Dr. Jean Kaseya, Director General of Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. "I think the continent wants this agreement. I think the world wants this agreement." Further meetings aimed at reaching an agreement are being planned. This treaty would be binding on members of the World Health Organization, but would not mandate national policies such as masking. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. 16.5 million Latinos voted in 2020. That was a 48% increase from the 12.7 million who voted in 2016. Meanwhile, political pundits in the U.S. have increasingly spoke about the importance of the Latino vote. Noreen Shagru is the Vice President of Research for the Chicago-based Latino Policy Forum. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the latest research on Latino voters.
For years now, we've been hearing about the importance of the Latino vote. What would you say is the most significant thing to know about that voting bloc? Well, you couldn't really call it a bloc, but about Latino voters in 2024?
Well, I think first it's really important to understand that Latinos are not a monolithic group, and that while the majority of Latinos in the United States and in Illinois, it's an even greater percentage, are of Mexican heritage. In fact, the Latino population represents a large number of ethnic groups, different countries of origin, and all of those make a difference. Having said that, I think it's important to also know that Latinos are not an immigrant population. The majority of Latinos are, in fact, U.S. citizens. And when you have a population that has been historically, the preponderance of the population has been immigrants, and they move into citizenship roles, that means their ability to vote matters. And the Latino population is an essential voting group. Depending upon what state you're in is depending upon how you want to treat the Latino bloc. So in Florida, you care much more, for example, about Cuban bloc than you would in Illinois, even though there's a measurable portion of Latinos are Cuban. That's not really where the political base would be. I think one thing that we see that's common among Latinos is that across the board, neither party speaks to Latinos. In many ways, one of the most interesting findings is that some of the polls, especially one of Pew's, if you look at the top five concerns among voters who identify as Latino, immigration is not listed as one of those top five. When you look at the non-Latino population, immigration is listed among the top five. The Latino population lists in its top five what we call the kitchen table issues: jobs, school, healthcare, housing costs. Those are the things that matter. And yet, I think what we see from both parties is not a full understanding of the monolithic character of the Latino population and the fact that immigration... The non-monolithic character. And that immigration isn't going to be the factor that is going to resonate with Latinos. One of the other things is how you reach Latinos, because so many Latinos, and I'm thinking here in Illinois, do live in households where Spanish is still spoken. And although a majority of Latinos get their news and information same place everybody else does, there still is a large presence of Latino media. And in the last off-cycle election, there was, in the Chicago media market, there was roughly $100 million spent. There was less than $2 million spent in the Spanish-speaking market. That is, to me, a kind of shocking figure, given that the population growth in this country, and even in a state like Illinois, where we lost a little bit of population, we didn't lose more because of the Latino population. So you would think that political parties would understand this is a voting group and you've got to reach them.
Is there a substantial generation gap among Latinos?
Well, Latinos trend young. And Latinos, their mean and median age is significantly younger than for whites and blacks. And when you look at the proportion of voters, say, under 45, and I'll give you Illinois statistics. Illinois is sort of a very good gauge for much of the population, much of the of understanding a lot of what's going on in the U.S. It's not a perfect replication, but it's good. Almost half those voters are under 44 years old, and only about 21% are over 55. When you look at the white voters, more than half are older. And so what you're really seeing is that Latinos are a younger voting bloc, and whites and blacks tend to be older voters. Their population is aging. What that means is that we have a very interesting finding. If you get Latinos registered, they vote not as quite as high percent vote as they do in the black or the white community, but it's a pretty high proportion of registered voters who actually vote. However, the percent of eligible voters who are registered is lowest among Latinos. And in part, it's because it's a relatively young population, and we know whether it's blacks, whites, or Latinos, young people do not vote at the same rate. They don't register at the same rate as older people do.
I've heard in recent years that there's a shift among Latinos more towards Republicans and more towards Trump. Is that true, or has that been exaggerated?
You have to remember that when Bush the Younger was elected, he garnered over 40 or 42% of the Latino vote.
He was Spanish speaking, I remember. Yeah.
Yes, but it was more than that.
He understood that the need for undocumented people to work in the U.S.
Oh, yeah, but undocumented people don't vote. But what he understood was talking to Latinos about the issues that matter to them: housing, jobs, education, healthcare. Whether you agree with someone's policies or not, if they're the only ones reaching out to you, you're going to see that. There is a large percent, significant percent, not large, significant percent that have voted for Trump and appear to be leaning towards Trump in this upcoming election. But in many ways, their reasons are very similar to what you hear among for example, white suburbanites. My 401k did great. Eggs did not cost $8 a dozen at the grocery store. We didn't have supply chain problems. You know, somebody, an economist once told me, when the economy is good, a president gets too much credit. When the economy's bad, a president gets too much blame. And so, you know, I think back to, what's his name? Mary Matlin's husband.
The bald guy.
James Carville.
James Carville, yeah.
And what did he say? It's the economy, stupid. And for Latinos, remember, they have the highest rates of labor force participation among racial and ethnic groups. Latinas are growing the labor force, yet Latinas among all racial and ethnic groups have the lowest median earned weekly income. When you are people that a group, whatever group, however you cut the demographics, when you're a group that is working, is not making a lot of money. In Illinois, for example, nearly 50% of workers, Latino workers, make $15 an hour or less. And they have the lowest per capita income among racial and ethnic groups. They also, Latinos also have the lowest rates of health insurance coverage among racial and ethnic groups. They want somebody who's speaking to those issues.
So if the Democrats say, look, we're for a higher minimum wage and we're for more worker protection and we're for more unemployment insurance benefits, does that resonate? If the Biden administration points out, look, our numbers are much better than they were under the Trump administration, do people care about that?
I think people care about what, and this is true whether you're Latino, Black, white, Asian, whatever. I think people care about how they feel in their personal life. And I think that the Democrats have sort of failed to resonate and explain what is going on in people's lives. When you think about it, many of their solutions seem very complicated. And that's because these are complicated issues. In many ways, Trump offers soundbite solutions. And when people are struggling economically, when they want to know how they're going to pay for their kids' college, when their kids who are going to college can't fill out a FAFSA form because the government couldn't figure out how to get the FAFSA form out there and ready for use, they're not helping your personal life. And I think that we have to understand that Latinos have an ability to really impact election outcomes and therefore policy outcomes, judicial appointments, and resource allocations. But in order to do that, the parties have to speak to Latinos and they have to speak to issues and they have to speak to what matters in their lives. And what we know from a lot of the research that we've seen and just from talking to people is they don't feel like they're being spoken to and they don't feel as if they're being heard. And this is the population, the demographic that is making sure that we don't lose more population than we have.
So the issues that the media tends to emphasize often, such as abortion or right now the war in Gaza, the Latino voters as a whole wouldn't pay that much attention to that, would you say?
I don't know the answer to that question because I haven't seen the breakdown on the Gaza-Israeli situation.
Well, the polls do show that the majority of Americans favor a ceasefire, for example.
Right. But I can't speak to specifically what the Latino breakdown looks like because I have not seen that racial and ethnic breakdown.
Can you think of, we know there's locales like cities where the Latino vote has been very decisive in electing, say, mayors or city council people. Are there states where that's been true in terms of races for governor or senator, for example?
Well, of course, New Mexico. And we know that the Latino vote is going to matter in Arizona and in Nevada. We know the Latino vote matters in Texas. And we know that the Latino vote matters in California. And it matters in Illinois as well. And what is interesting, I think, that the parties have to figure out is how you reach Latinos in destinations that historically have not been Latino destinations, but are actually growing. They were referred to about 15 years ago as the new destination. What happens in states like North Carolina? What happens in states like Georgia, where you may begin to see increasing numbers of Latino citizens? And how are they registering? Are they voting? And who are they voting for? And that's something I think we really need to watch very carefully at the national level. And in terms at the state and local level, again, thinking about Illinois, the majority of Latinos live in the Chicago suburbs, not in Chicago. And so what happens when Latinos move to municipalities where they historically have not lived? And we know from research we do on housing and some stuff we have in the pipeline that they're moving to suburbs that many of them are moving to suburbs that historically have not had large Latino populations. What does the move to the suburbs and to municipalities outside of those traditional areas, what is that going to do to elections at the state and local level for state house and local municipal levels? And we know that especially if Trump wins in November, that the actions and the policy movement to help better people's lives is going to be at the state and local level. It's not going to come from the federal government.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
I think that watching the Latino vote is going to be extremely important. I think really understanding the role that Latino plays, particularly in states like Arizona and Nevada, is going to be extremely important in November. And, you know, I hope that both parties figure out a way to reach and message and listen what this population, which is so important to the economic and social stability of the country, what they have to say and how you can meet the needs that they say they have.
That was Noreen Shagru of the Latino Policy Forum speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg about the role that Latino voters may play in the upcoming election. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings.
We're the fifth graders from David Douglas Tag Center. We listen to KBOO.